2004 Salt Lake Sunstone Symposium presents Session 325, Race, Religion, and Critical Pedagogy in the Classroom, Struggling Against Racism in a Conservative Context, a paper presented by Darren Smith, with a response by Michael J. Stevens.
Since that time, of course, the doctrine has changed, but it takes a lot longer to change hearts and minds and habits. Our speaker today, Darren Smith, is involved in trying to do some of them, to make some of those changes happen. Darren's a doctoral candidate in the Education, Culture, and Society program at the University of Utah. He's co-editor of a forthcoming book called Black and Mormon from the University of Illinois Press. And is the editor of a semi-regular Sunstone column called The Long Promised Day. He teaches at UBSC and at BYU, lives in Provo with his wife, Joy, and their daughters, Egan and Kisa. Our responder will be Mike Stevens, who's a long-time Sunstone person, a member of Sunstone Board of Directors, Mike's a management professor at the University of Missouri at St. Louis, where he teaches and conducts workshops in organizational behavior and leadership, specializing in improving organizational performance through empowerment and teamwork and interpersonal effectiveness in the workplace. He says that his highest and holiest calling in the church has been assistant nursery leader, which permits him to play games, take naps, and eat while at church. He's got it down. So, that much said, Darren, it's all yours.
All right. This particular paper is a draft that I'm in the process of working, but maybe when it's done, you folks can offer some suggestions or some questions and we move forward. Teaching a course on the African American experience at a predominantly white conservative institution has many challenges. Of particular interest is the resistance that comes from white students and culturally white students of African descent who are unfamiliar with or in denial of racialized discourses. As the recipient of racial propaganda they inherit from their peers, friends, the media, family members, and the larger social order, they become classroom instigators, committed to promoting and protecting white privilege that remains sacred to them. They are not likely to abandon their beliefs. This has certainly been my experience at Brigham Young University, the academic flagship of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. In spite of my best efforts to unveil the historical aspects of the marginality of black Americans, my white students often cannot see a direct correlation between institutional racism and the benefits they enjoy as whites. But it is not that simple. When teaching about the concept of white privilege and how white people profit from racial and class divisions in the U.S., many students assume that because they are not mean to African Americans, they are not racist. Indeed, many of them believe that they are good people, even while they think and act in anti-black ways. According to sociologists Fagan, Vera, and Bertar, this phenomenon is known as sincere fictions, which is a form of white privilege. Peggy McIntosh, the associate director of the Wellesley College Center for Research on Women, maintains that white privilege presents itself in many subtle ways and that white people are not always aware of it. It is well understood in the social science literature that race is a social construction, shaped through a long, sordid history of economic and racial struggle. In a capitalist-based economy such as the United States, the complex matrix of race, class, and gender intersect to create economic and social inequality for poor whites and black Americans on the one hand, while rendering white skin privilege as invisible. Many black students at BYU bring to the classroom a complexity of thought and experiences, which I have learned not to take for granted. Just because a person is phenotypically black, like me, does not mean that they understand or identify with the interests of black Americans as a whole. The idea that blacks are a monolithic group is contrary to my own personal experiences associating with other African Americans in general and black Mormons in particular. Black Mormons who reside in Utah County tend to be tend to be politically conservative like their white contemporaries. When I use the construct conservative, I mean in the political sense of how the right, in particular, the fraternal order of white manhood, commodifies the notion of values for political gain. Black Americans in general are very conservative in terms of values. That's vis-a-vis sexuality, education, and marriage, that the political and religious right continually espouses. There's a big difference between values and politics, however. When you see Black Americans manifest what is considered political left leanings, it is typically in the area of civil rights policies that generally impact equality of opportunity and access to education, access to economic and social mobility for blacks, women, and other people of color. The African-American students that I've interacted with apparently come from families who are middle and upper class, who believe that America has done just about enough through its civil rights legislation to make good on its promises of equality for all. They are apt to be imbued with class privilege, which reinforces their perception that racism is no longer a significant American problem. Much of this thinking can be found in the classroom, in my classroom, in any given semester, among a good portion of the small percentage of black students that I've taught. Interestingly enough, the vast majority of these young people are either the biological offspring of mixed marriages between blacks and whites, or are adopted children of white Mormon families, which seems to be a growing trend here in Utah. Yet despite the fact that these students come from divergent economic situations and social conditions, what they do share in common is that the larger BYU community identifies them as black, which makes them the target of a multitude of racial stereotypes. So eventually they must deal with what they've come to deny, the American dilemma of race. The process whereby European physical anthropologists and later American science of the 18th and 19th centuries developed a racialized caste system that would classify, order, and rank groups based on physical features constitutes one of the greatest tragedies in human history. The singling out of racial characteristics was done in part to mark groups, distinguishing them from white. As a result of these white classification systems, people of African descent and other groups of color would become the object of what would later develop into a racialized system of indifference based on skin color and capital, which had a global influence. Whether my students were adopted or come from mainline Mormon families matters little, because a large portion of them are often backgrounds in which such ideas as the importance of individuality and merit-based rewards are highly valued. These ideological constructions of the self are not necessarily unique to Utah or the LDS faith, but when coupled with the orthodox religious perspective of Mormonism, such ideas take on a whole other dimension. America's dominant discourse of liberalism, things like individuality, liberalism, egalitarianism, and universality, is intertwined with Mormonism's accepted and unquestioned religious teachings. In this conservative climate, ideas are not just political and social articulations by individuals, but rather institutionally sanctioned pronouncements by God. Having been informed by liberalism, which is the dominant ideology, and Mormonism's conservative beliefs and practices about racial differences and the role of women, many students at BYU are obliged to beckon the idea of merit-based rewards when examining African-American culture, and assume that blacks need only pull themselves up by their bootstraps to be successful in U.S. society, that if blacks only work harder, their lives will be much better. Many students, of course, in my course, go beyond individual merit as a simple explanation for why blacks were denied the priesthood in the first place, for example. They quite frequently intertwine a racist folklore and Mormonism that blacks were and are still, to some extent, under divine curse with the liberal frames of individualism and merit. The particular frame of merit is analogous to the Calvinist notion of predestination, which Mormons denounce and have even canonized in their second article of faith, which expressly states, and I quote, "Men will be punished for their own sins and not for Adam's transgressions," close quote. As Mormons come to understand this phrase, as Mormons come to understand this phrase, it has reference to individuals as having personal agency over their salvation. Yet many students who summon the racist folklore of Mormonism about blacks maintained that they were allegedly cursed collectively. In essence, they argue against their own interests. What one black person does affects all black people equally is how I read this seeming paradox. The belief that many Mormons claim regarding the cursed lineage of blacks resulted in two specific discourses about the black body in antiquity. The first idea originated in early Judeo-Christian tradition about blacks being cursed by God, because Ham saw his father Noah in a drunken stupor. Noah pronounced a curse on Ham that he would be, quote-unquote, servants of servants to his siblings. According to Stephen R. Hames, a professor of religious studies, in Western Europe, prior to the modern period, the curse was invoked to explain the origins of slavery, the black skin, and the exile of Hamites to the less wholesome regions of the earth. But these aspects of malediction were not integrated in an explicit justification for racial slavery into the 15th century, when dark-skinned peoples were enslaved by the Portuguese and the Spanish, and the European slave stereotype was stabilized. The religious idea, as close quote, the religious idea was used as a justification for placing blacks in bondage. The second model, in contrast, is early theological beliefs. Mormon leaders and scholars specifically supposed that the so-called curse on people of African descent initially began because Cain murdered his brother Abel. Cain was thought to have been given black skin by God to signify his transgressions. And Cain's progenitor, the so-called black race, were to be forever marked, enslaved to their white brethren, beaten, raped, and denied the opportunities of freedom and liberty until God chose to lift the ban. Fortunately for people of African descent who happened to belong to the Mormon faith, God spoke to his prophet, Spencer W. Kimball, the 12th president of the LDS Church, and as a result of that prayerful conversation on June 7, 1978, the official priesthood ban was lifted. In the aftermath of the media frenzy that followed the Mormon Church's official announcement and in hearty congratulations by the former president of the United States, Jimmy Carter, 25 years later, many students at BYU continue to remind me of my former curse status, and my black students remain resolute that the white church leaders know more about what's best for black folks, thus effectively absolving whites of racist practices. I am troubled by how many students and church members offer LDS racist folklore as a reasonable explanation for black priesthood denial. And this belief has racially primed them to view people of African descent as inferior. LDS church members believe that in a pre-earthly state, a war ensued between Jesus Christ and Lucifer, thus called the war in heaven. This war recognized or required mortals to choose whether to follow Christ, who offered salvation on the basis of freely chosen obedience, or Lucifer, who guaranteed salvation but did not give mortals free choice. Christ's plan was chosen by spirits who were presumably white, so Lucifer was expelled from his premortal realm, along with his followers, who became evil spirits dedicated to tempting human beings. The story continues. There were other spirits who, in the pre-earthly state, could not decide whether or not to follow Lucifer or Christ's plan. This group is thought to have been black. They would have abstained from any vote. However, according to Joseph Elding Smith, the 10th president of the LDS Church, quote, there were no neutrals in the war in heaven. All took sides, either with Christ or with Satan. Every man had his agency there. And men receive rewards here based on their actions there, just as they will receive rewards hereafter for deeds done in the body. Close quote. I'm sorry, it's a continuation of the quote. The Negro evidently is receiving the rewards he merits. Close quote. Joseph Elding Smith supposed that contemporary black suffering at the hands of whites and the denial of Mormon priesthood to black males resulted from their premortal life, as opposed to the preponderance of racism and global white supremacy. Blacks only had themselves to blame. They refused to choose sides during the war in heaven. To outsiders of the LDS faith, this logic of withholding the priesthood from blacks must appear strange indeed. And what is more disturbing is that it remains a significant part of Mormon folklore and a great source of contention for progressive white and black Mormons. Leaders of the LDS Church have yet to publicly repudiate these teachings. So consequently, Many congregants unwittingly retell these stories to other members of the faith and potential black converts in an attempt to make clear God's way of thinking, thus perpetuating a heavy investment in white supremacy at the expense of black members. The racist folklore regarding the status of blacks in the pre-earthly state and the Cain thesis is distinctive in Mormonism, and many students continually use these troubling explanations to rationalize the black experience in the United States in general and the Mormon faith in particular. Racial scripts, such as the ones mentioned above, are prejudicially handed down from one generation of Mormons to the next in the form of media, religious instruction, stock stories, and folk tales. In the LDS faith, the racist folklore behind the black priesthood restriction is an enduring truth that many students fervently defend. It is simply not within my realm of expertise to dare question the veracity of inspired teaching on the subject of racism in the Mormon Church at any time, lest I experience bitter backlash. The walls the students build in order to guard themselves from heresy or false doctrines of men that many of them believe that I engage in is disconcerting to say the least. In the next section of this paper, I want to focus my attention to the necessity of critical pedagogy as an analytical tool to help my students to unearth alarming assumptions they cleave to about the truthfulness of church discourses regarding the exclusion of African Americans. Each semester that I teach any course that addresses the history of racism at BYU, I prepare myself for the difficulty in this process by not taking any of the comments that my students make personally. I recognize that they have been taught to speak the discourse of liberalism and Mormon racist folklore as their families, friends, and environment dictate. They live in circumstances where privilege abounds, and for them, it is because of God's blessings that they and their families are so prosperous. According to Gerald Fagan, quote, white privilege entails the set of benefits and advantages inherited by each generation of those defined as white in the social process and structure of the U.S. society. The actual privilege and sense that one is entitled to them are inseparable parts of a greater whole. These white advantages can be material, symbolic, and psychological, close quote. The scriptures, as they interpret them, maintain and reinforce this reality. The majority of my students cannot or refuse to see the deeper issues of race, class, and privilege, race, class, and gender politics as a factor in their affluence. It is understandable, then, that to engage and to unravel this perspective of oneself can cause considerable anxiety and resistance. I am disclosing my beliefs to situate my dialogue with the reader as clearly and as candidly as possible. I write from the position of a convert to Mormonism who chose the faith for the attractiveness of its doctrines, the commitment to healthy family life, and the empowerment inherent in its principles of eternal progression. I have not always been a member of the faith and have not had the years of socialization in a Mormon family to solidify my racial beliefs. Hence, the whole of my identity does not revolve around how I see myself in the greater context of U.S. society as Mormon. I do not have the privilege, as whites do, to dismiss the everyday reality of race by believing that racism is something that ignorant people do, when I know fully well that this phenomenon we humans call race institutionally shapes the quality of my life and people of color in significant ways. My membership in the LDS faith is predicated to some extent on my acceptance of the racist folklore that I and my forebears were at one time under a divine curse. This is essentially what black converts in the LDS church are implicitly expected to do. Being converted to Mormonism means that you agree to follow the teachings of church leaders, regardless of how long-headed these teachings may be. Even though some church leaders are quick to point out the need for church members to think carefully and critically about their teachings, many remain resolute that when church leaders speak, they speak for the Lord and the thinking stops. Until the LDS Church authoritatively denounces and strongly discourages the use of racist folklore as a source of truth in its canon, such prejudice against blacks will continue. When the history of Mormonism's racist past is discussed in the classroom, the standard response that I've had from both white and black members is, we, Mormons, do not know why they, blacks, could not hold the priesthood, but we are confident that the Lord must have had a good reason. Students in my class repeatedly used the Lord as a scapegoat for white racism, thereby absolving white Mormons of their responsibility toward ending racist teachings which are commonly used. Bringing my students to an awareness and understanding of the complexities of societal racism as it pertains to Mormonism's racist past is an extraordinarily difficult process. Many believe that the LDS Church is infallible. There is an unyielding belief among members of the LDS faith that the leadership is simply not capable of error. The idea that the church was racist, as were many other white-dominated institutions, in denying blacks full participation is not within the realm of possibility for many of my students. If the church made a mistake, they reason, then how could it be true? God would not allow leaders of the church to lead the institution astray, they reason. In their minds, racism is one of those societal issues that God would not condone. Therefore, the church could not have erred because God commanded the brethren, the general leadership of the church, that the time was not right for blacks. I start my critical analysis from the perception that many of my students presume that the church is incapable of racist practices. To question whether or not the LDS Church was guilty of racism and still condones, through its reticence, the racist folklore regarding blacks is a major ordeal. I realize the difficulty that teaching students to think critically about their own reality can cause considerable stress, especially when these young people believe fervently that the church is their means to salvation. Yet it is unacceptable for them to avoid the discussion because they fear religious acceptance of Mormonism is in jeopardy by challenging the assumptions of church wisdom regarding blacks. A frank and open discussion about the church's past is precisely what is needed. Peter McLaren, a professor of critical pedagogy at the University of Southern California, correctly notes that, quote, critical theorists begin with the premise that men and women are essentially unfree and inhabit a world riddled with contradiction and asymmetries of power and privilege. The critical educator endorses theories that are first and foremost dialectical. That is, theories which recognize the problems of society as more than simply isolated events of individuals or deficiencies in the society as a whole. Close quote. I do not begin a semester by talking about the LDS Church's past, but rather begin with larger themes of racism and discrimination in U.S. society. We begin discussing the transatlantic slave trade and the rise of capitalism in the West. I articulate that the wealth of U.S. society has been on the backs of blacks. Slavery gave America the financial resources to launch the Industrial Revolution, which continues to impact the economy currently. It is important for my students to know that there were a number of race theories that emerged in the 18th, 19th, and 20th centuries, which attempted to justify black oppression at the hands of whites. These theories were not limited to science alone, but broadened its scope to include theology. Religion was one of the major purveyors of racist thinking, since the concept of race came into existence. And God has been used by Europeans in a number of ways to justify colonial expansion, brutality, and unspeakable acts of terror against melanated peoples the world over. I draw a connection between the larger discrimination in society and racist perceptions in which white Americans frequently employ to make sense of their reality. In this context, race can be understood as a prism of difference, a schema that makes available distortions and misperceptions that members of the dominant group have about African Americans and other people of color. Getting my students to develop a greater understanding of race consciousness is a Herculean task, given that many of them believe that church leaders are infallible and know more about the lived experience of being black than blacks themselves. It simply does not matter what knowledge I possess about my own experience being black in America. Despite my best efforts to prepare these students, however, many are able to get past the teaching so common in the church that the mostly white male leadership is inspired in all matters, including race. The transformation from uncritical to critical thinker is a long and arduous process, one that I contend cannot take place over a 16-week period in a semester. But certainly there's a seed planted, and there's been some manure thrown on the seeds to help it to fertilize and to grow. That may extend beyond that semester. That's certainly my hope. And the evidence of that is the letters that I get back from students occasionally, the emails that I get back from students who have gone on out into the world, into a diverse world. And they've responded back to me by saying, I'm sorry for being a pain in the butt in your class. I see what you were getting at the time. And those were often very, very nice moments for me. In some, teaching at a religious institution and trying to flesh out deeply ingrained notions of racism, racism in U.S. society requires me to have patience and long-suffering. I'm quite sure that many students see me as an angry black man, a moniker that I proudly wear. And I'll end with that. But let me say this about this issue of teaching critical pedagogy to white students in terms of, this is, by the way, before I say, let me preface this by saying this paper is still a draft, so I'm going to get into more specifics in terms of what I do pedagogically in the classroom and in terms of curriculum. But I was talking to Michael just a minute ago about some of these ideas. I want to say this particular process. I have found it, in my own experience in the classroom, absolutely essential that I integrate what is known as whiteness theory, which is a theoretical perspective that started really with Du Bois. But, you know, white folks claimed it, so they say that it started 20 years ago. Okay? So, and this particular theoretical framework, what it does is it attempts to help white students to see themselves in the text as opposed to talking about difference as if it's out here. So here my difference is there. It tends to help my students to put themselves in situations where they actually see what their forebears did to lay down institutional structures whereby they benefit today. And I think that's extraordinarily helpful in helping my students develop empathy and develop greater understanding for the experiences of folks of color. One of the things that I wanted to indicate in this paper, and I talked a lot, at least in the initial phase, I talked about the experiences I've had with blacks, because I want to illustrate that blacks are not a monolith. That typically, my experience with African Americans who've been Mormon in this community, more often than not, they have been pretty middle class and pretty conservative. In that sense. And so conservatism as a discourse, as an ideology, transcends whiteness. It transcends Chicanoness. It transcends a number of racial categorizations. And so it doesn't surprise me that blacks that join the church, and Kim, you could probably speak more to this in your experience in Atlanta, tend to be more like their whites, the white contemporaries in the wards, in the stakes, in the branches whereby they attend. And which is one of the reasons why there's such a dearth of blacks, I think, in the church, because we're not extending that beyond middle classdom, right? I had a mission president tell me when I was serving in Michigan. He said, Darren, don't go into East Michigan, because in East Michigan there are no builders there who can build the kingdom. The assumption being that there were working class blacks, poor blacks in that community who couldn't build the church. They would take more from the church than give to the church. Go to North Muskegon, Michigan, where there's more builders that the church can facilitate. Until we change this mentality, until white people begin to be as outraged about racism as people of color, and until men begin to be as outraged about sexism as women are, we're not going to make any changes. We're going to continue to be stagnant, and we're going to continue to romanticize what change could look like. So part of that process, I believe, as a church, as individuals, is to begin to ask questions about our own subjectivity and about how that subjectivity lends itself to continued discrimination and racist practices within the kingdom. Now, I think if we do that, we might have some significant changes, particularly at the local level. So I think that the responsibility for social change doesn't necessarily lie with me, the lone black guy, but lies more with you all as the majority of the membership, particularly in Utah, to ask questions about your own subjectivity. I'm going to underscore that, because that, I think, is where the beginning starts. And what I try to do in the class is to try to facilitate that process with my students and to encourage them and to help them to get to that process and help them to recognize you can do that, right, without falling away. You can be critical, right, without leaving the institution. Some people can. Some people, when they discover new things, it drives them out. Others find ways to justify and reconcile why they're still in. But, nevertheless, I want my students to have to be courageous in this endeavor. Now, I want to also say this last point, and I'll let Michael respond to this, is that it comes at a great price for white students. It's equally as it comes as a great price for me to teach this to white students. And here's the difference. When I'm teaching class and I'm lecturing, right, my body is already politicized. When I step up on the stage and teach contrary to what whites have been taught about the world as they know it, right, as it's been created through the guise of Eurocentrism, right, I am already political, period. I cannot shake that, right? I can't shake that political structure that's been pasted on my body. Whereas whites, when whites get up and do it, right, it has a whole different tone to it. But the love that whites get from their family and friends is very similar to the love I get from students in the classroom on occasion. Friends and family members don't want to hear you talk about your liberal ways of looking at race and your liberal ways of looking at gender or whatever the issues might be in many, many respects. So whites also suffer some backlash when they try to be quote-unquote progressive. That's why to this day I literally only know maybe 5 progressive white people, right, who are willing to lay it on the line, right, who are willing to fight for freedom and justice in the cause of liberation. And a whole lot of them out there. It's one of the reasons why I think that McIntyre says that this is so invidious, it's so ingrained, that many folks just, for whatever reason, just don't find it necessary to step outside of their comfort zone for fear of being disciplined. Foucault talks about power as a sort of a circulatory notion, and one way that power is exercised over us is in our reticence. Right, so we have to, in order to move toward change, I submit to you that we need to get smart about this issue, and we need to start asking deeper questions about the implications of race and how it's played out in the religious context. I'll leave that with you. Thank you.
Well, if I could start, let me begin by asking for a show of hands. How many racists do we have here this morning? 2 and a couple of reluctant. See how invidious it is? I'm a racist. Hi, my name is Mike. I'm a racist. This is a 12-step program for those of you. What do I mean by that? Well, I'll come back to it. I got a copy of Dent's paper a few weeks back, had the chance to read through it. Wasn't expecting this this last couple of minutes, but I think it was inspired because it was a nice segue into what I felt impressed I wanted to share in terms of the reaction. I don't think any of us would disagree that there needs to be a fundamental shift in terms of the underlying paradigms that drive the racism, not only in the church, but in culture widely. My own interest in background is not in issues of race directly, but more broadly in issues of what I call rankism. I don't know how many of you have heard this term. It was coined by an academic colleague, but rankism is essentially the idea that we all have social constructions where we have people of higher status and lower status based on all sorts of categories, whether it's race, whether it's sex, whether it's economics, whether it's social status, etc. Ethnic origin, country of origin, and so on. Rankism and all of its stripes and varieties all suffer from these same central issues that are so invidious that keep us from seeing ourselves first. Now, in my own experience with rankism, I have been over the years trying to help teach leadership development classes. One of the classes I teach is a class I call Leadership Through People Skills. The biggest obstacle I have in getting students through that class and to improve their people skills is that nobody needs it. Everybody I run into, you have these invitations like social events. You meet somebody, oh, what do you do? I'm a professor, and usually their eyes glaze over. But if they don't, they continue, oh, what do you teach? And, you know, one of those like 30-second social interactions. I may describe the class. It's a class on leadership through people skills. I try to help managers and people in positions of authority overcome their unrighteous dominion. I don't actually use that word, but that's essentially what it is. Try to help managers overcome their nature to unrighteous dominion and engage and bring people in and create a community of empowerment. Usually at that point in the conversation, the next thing out of the other person's mouth to me is, oh, I've got to introduce you to my manager. How many people at this point in this conversation do you think ever say to me, oh no, I am so glad I ran into you. Tell me, is this a class that I can sign up and take? It's happened once, and that person is my mother, so it doesn't really count. She would have taken the class anyway, but... So I have struggled with this question of how do you move people through these barriers to change, right? And I don't have an ideal answer, but let me just share a couple of things as I work with unrighteous dominionators to overcome the barriers to change from unrighteous dominion to a state of empowerment and true engagement with other people. First big barrier I always face is actually a barrier with two elements to it. It's what I call cognitive barriers, and the first subpoint under cognitive barriers is that a lot of times people don't change because they don't have good mental models. Okay? They don't have good mental models. So it is absolutely essential that you help them strip away the mental models that lock them into their only options. Now, when it comes to issues of race, those mental models, I think, are very well captured and described in whiteness theory. Because race and racism is a social construction. It is about mental models. Okay? It's not about biology. It is about mental models. And so one of the things you need to do is you need to help people sort through mental models. You can present new mental models to people, and that can be groundbreaking. They can see a new paradigm, and if they embrace that paradigm, that's absolutely wonderful. Now, for example, I do my leadership training. A lot of times managers think their only options are to be an autocratic bully who pushes and dominates and insists and demands in order to get things done. Or, what's the other alternative? You be a patsy, roll over, make people happy, be the country club manager, right? Now, if that's the mental model, you only got those two choices, what are you going to pick? Don't answer. Because you're not supposed to pick. You're supposed to say, why are those the only two alternatives? Well, you present a mental model, or an additional alternative. You know, give people a new mental model. You got this option where you can be assertive but respectful. You don't have to be passive and respectful. You can. There are things you can do. There are strategies, skills, behaviors, and so on. You give people a mental model. Usually, though, the second barrier to change is what I call the self-awareness bias. That's a cognitive barrier, which keeps racists from seeing themselves as racists, which is why it's so invidious, right? I've got people who see this mental model where you present the idea that, you know, as a leadership option, they can be assertive and respectful, but it's, oh, yeah, that's what I've been. Well, not if you ask people with whom they work and interact. So you need to work people. The mental model is usually the easy part. The self-awareness bias is a lot harder. And that's a challenge. But there are some things that you can do as an instructor to help people work through these self-awareness biases so that they can begin to see the way in which their own beliefs, attitudes, and constructs are so invidious. And some of those techniques are, I think, embodied in the New Testament, right? We talk about Jesus as the Master. Anybody in here speak Spanish? What's the translation in Spanish for the word Master? Lord, maestro. And when we translate that back into English, what do we translate maestro? Teacher, right? He's the master because he's the great teacher. How did he often teach?
Parables.
Parabolic, indirect, roundabout. Yeah? Give you a parable to show how useful parables are. You've all heard the story about the contest between the wind and the sun, right? Those of you who haven't, 30-second version is the wind and the sun one day are boasting to each other, each bragging about how the other is more powerful. And the sun talks about how he has the warmth and the rays and can bring life to the earth. And the wind says, "That's nothing. You know, I can send tornadoes to wipe out Florida and destroy armies, and I can move ships around the world if I, with my rays. And I'm much more powerful." And so they decide to have a contest. And the sun throws out a challenge and says, "Well, you see that fellow walking along the road down there wearing that coat? We'll have a contest. The one who can get that man to get the coat off that man will conclude as the most powerful." So the wind goes first, and what does the wind do? He tries to blow the coat off that man. He blows harder and harder and harder, and as a result, the man responds by drawing his jacket even tighter. On the other hand, when the sun comes out and just warms up the place, and the man realizes that he needs to take his coat off himself, and that's exactly what happens. Now, that's parabolic. It's an indirect way of getting through the self-awareness biases and mental models. So, Darren, I think, is exactly right when he says that when he stands up in front of a class of white Mormons, he is immediately politicized before he even says anything. So how can you get those white Mormons to open up and begin to see that they need to take their coats off, because they don't even see that need? Well, some of the things that I've found are possible is that you invite people to give you their arguments for why they have a particular position. And, you know, what you need to do is sometimes you have to structure the rules a little bit. For example, invite them to write a paper in which they demonstrate only through the scriptures that blacks, in fact, were less valuable than the pre-existence. Any of you have thrown this challenge out to other people? I've done it once or twice in gospel doctrine class. Just throw it out. Now, you don't have to come back and say, "No, you're wrong. That is not what the scriptures teach." You just turn around. Throw out a question. Well, blacks were less valuable than pre-existence. Well, that's an interesting notion. Let's explore that in the scriptures. Which passages should we turn to and read? And then you let them talk. Now, what they find is that they can't support that argument from the scriptures. Ask them to reconcile this mental framework that blacks were less valuable than the pre-existence with the article of faith that says men will be punished for their own sins, not for Adam's transgression. Now, they may struggle through it, and they may not be able to see that they need to take their coat off, and even though they're hot and sweating, they may refuse to take their coat off, but if you ask them to explain, "Oh, why is your coat on when it's so hot out here?" and then you let them talk, that's often what a good teacher will do. Have them write a paper reconciling the King Follett discourse on how every soul who comes into the world is capable of enlargement. Ask the teacher a lesson doesn't happen very often, but probably because of this experience, I began the class by writing on the chalkboard a statement and then invited everybody to respond. The statement was, the president of the church cannot rule in matters of faith or doctrine. True or false? I threw the question out to the high priest group, and they went wild for 45 minutes. Yes, no, maybe, gee, I don't know. And I just stood up in front and summarized. So one of the fun things about teaching in the church is if you come up with a really great question, all you have to do is guide and direct, and the thing kind of takes off by itself. Anybody in here recognize where that definition comes from? You just change one word, and you'll know where I lifted that definition. I lifted it from the Encyclopedia of Catholicism, right? Change the president of the church to the Pope, and that is what we were debating. Now, before I went into that priesthood meeting, I was not entirely sure whether or not I was going to tell them that's what we were debating, because it's like one of these human subject experiments. I don't know if you're familiar with like a research protocol where you might use human subjects, and sometimes you have to put students through an experiment, but you don't tell them exactly why you're doing what you're doing, because if you tell them why, it might color the way they react, and so on. So sometimes you need to deceive the subjects of your experiment in order to study what you're looking at. So this was a little, act of deception. I was asking them to debate the doctrine of Catholic infallibility without telling them that's what they were doing. So I wasn't entirely sure I was going to end with, "Oh, I got you." In fact, I was moving more towards the maybe I better not say anything at all and just kind of let them walk away with the discussion. But at the end, one of the other high priests asked me. About why I had come up with this particular statement. I said, "Well, I'll show you. I'll just change one word and erased on the board. So I erased the president, put the Pope, and just kind of left it at that." And like I said, they asked me back for a while to teach in Sunday school. But there are things that you can do to work people through their self-awareness biases, and throwing out the right kinds of questions, letting people talk, letting them answer is usually a very effective strategy. A couple of other barriers that I've also noticed, I'll end with this just 30 seconds, they're also affective barriers. Things feel uncomfortable, especially when you're getting people to change their thinking. That can often be a source of barrier to change. Sometimes the barriers have to do with skill sets that they lack. They don't have either the intellectual or the interpersonal or the social skills to engage either a question or people from other ethnic groups. Last of all, there are also moral and ethical barriers, which I think for Mormons goes back to the cognitive barriers, because it's hard for Mormons to sort out what is official and what is folklore. So, one of the nice ways to sort out these arguments is instead of coming back at people who quote McConkie or other people as, "Well, this is official church doctrine," just ask them, "Okay, in which book of official church doctrine do we read that?" And then just kind of listen and let them come to their own realization that determining what is official church doctrine is a very difficult thing, because we really don't have anything beyond the standard works, do we, as official church doctrine? We don't have a book of official first doctrine. We've got letters from the first presidency, we've got letters from the first presidency and the 12, but outside of standard works, it's pretty hard to identify. We need to go to Q&A, right? So I will leave it at that, and I guess Al will moderate.
Thank you, Mike. Now we know why the instructor in the high priest quorum is sometimes known as the referee. We have about 3 or 4 minutes for questions in deference to the people who will be in this room in a few minutes. Are there any questions for Derman and Mike? Yes. Yes, we go to that. That's right. We've got another about 10 minutes. Yes, if you want to come to the mic to ask your question, that would be appreciated.
I heard Darren twice so far, and Darren's a good friend of mine, and I guess this sounds somewhat self-promoting because we go quite a ways back. But one of the things that I found interesting in both your remarks, Darren, and your commentary is that you seem to be advocating kind of a grassroots pedagogy, trying to dispel this racist folklore from through means of maybe grassroots pedagogy, but it seems like it's going to be a long, laborious process. Whereas a lot of people, including Armin Moss and others, have really promoted the need for an official repudiation of the racist folklore. It seems like, and I guess my question is this, how this came up in yesterday's presentation, how do you get church leaders, some kind of an official statement or some kind of, to repudiate the racist folklore? The real dilemma to me seems that if they repudiate, the writings of Bruce R. McConkie or Joseph Fielding Smith or whatever, it somehow undermines their status as leaders of a prophetic church based on, continuous revelation or how do you resolve that dilemma? Can you do it through pedagogy, through the pedagogy that you had suggested, or is there something more needed? That's my question.
My 10-second answer is that I don't know, and I don't. It's not that I don't care, but I think that's the wrong question. As far as what I can do, as much as I love them, the brethren have yet to call me in for advice and what they ought to do and how they ought to change things. In the meantime, I am going to do the best I can to work with charity and love with my high priest group. And if they put me in front of gospel doctrine, I'll do it there. In the meantime, in other words, I'm going to forge ahead with the pedagogy and the tools and the teaching models that are available to me, and try to influence the world in the spheres where I have influence. And that, and if the others are interested in my suggestions about what they can do to move things along, then I'll be glad to share it with them. But it's a tough call.
Well, Darren, you have a response.
I agree with Mike. I mean, I don't think that the battle can be won at the in terms of the general leadership of the church. I think those individuals are just inaccessible to me. I don't have access to them, so I don't. And even if I did, I don't know if they would be as responsive to what I have to say about whiteness and white racism and all that kind of stuff. They might look at me like I'm crazy, like a lot of white people do when I say that stuff. So,
students every semester.
Yeah, and I have a captive audience, and that's where I'm going to exert my focus at.
I'm not a teacher, so I say this as not a teacher. And I don't like to think about battles. I like to think about peace. And I would suggest something like going in and saying to a class, in the premortal existence, I chose to be black. In fact, I pushed people out of the way. I wanted to come and be black. Now, you tell me all the reasons why I might have done something like that. And there are a whole lot of reasons why, the least shall be first. Look at Jesus. He was, there are just a lot of reasons. It makes them, really what they need is they need to be spiritually educated, and they need to be inspired, and they need to be creative in their own thinking. And, it's to get them to be outraged. I'm just not sure that's the highest goal.
I don't think my purpose is to get them to be outraged. I think my purpose is exactly what you said earlier, is to get them to tap into their spiritual side, to help them to be better spiritual beings. And part of obtaining peace, right, is to resolve personal conflict, right? We're not born necessarily. I think we have the capacity to be peaceful, but we are socialized in a number of contexts to war against one another for whatever reason. So my attention in my classroom, and I don't necessarily believe that teaching about race is a safe space. I mean, it implies that there's got to be an environment of love and commitment. Love can be radical too, right? And I think that sometimes we romanticize love in a way that we see on TV or in the movie, like the something Princess Woman, the lady who Princess Number Two, Princess Diaries Two. Like, we romanticize this because that's another model that we tend to we're socialized with. So I think that understanding, empathy, joy can come out of tension, right? And I think that I start from that premise. I have no choice, because the moment I start talking about this, it's tension, because it directly conflicts with what they've been taught and how they've been socialized as beings. My goal is to get them to peace, get them to resolve personal conflicts that they have inside themselves that may contribute or inhibit the process of growth.
Some conversations are just so well.
Absolutely. You know, race, politics, and religion, right? Those are the three that
my new
You know, and I don't have a magic answer for that. I try to demystify the traditional space of the classroom. And what I mean by that is this. Rather than having students look at the backs of each other's heads like you folks are doing, I make them look at each other, right, and dialogue them. I found that to be the most successful way to get them to sort of open up, is to have them dialogue, not necessarily with me, but to each other. Because oftentimes within that group, there are students who are thinking more progressively than others. And that really does a lot. So I try to facilitate. Yeah, I try to facilitate more. Yeah.
I like that, because Carl Jung says that if you want somebody to think, you get two fools together, and then one of them will have to start thinking.
Well, as one of the melanin deprived, it bothers me occasionally when it seems like I am being blamed for the sins of my predecessors. You know, because I'm white, therefore I'm a racist. It bothers me a little bit that seems to be a direction that you're taking. It may be that I'm a racist because I'm not perfect, but I certainly try not to be. And it bothers me that by treating whites as monolithic, you're making the same mistake that whites have made for years in treating all blacks as a monolithic group. Would you care to comment on that?
Absolutely. That's a great comment, and that's one of the frequent comments I get from my students. So, and it goes back to what I think what Mike was talking about. This is where Mike and I agree or disagree, because I'm looking at racism more as a structure, right? More as a larger institutional practice. If you look at racism as an individual acts of meanness, right, that people do to other people, then you can sort of wiggle your way out of racism, right, as something that people are labeled as doing. The reason why I look at racism as a structure is because everything that we do in society, institutional practices, the way that methods have been created, policies have been constructed, have been done in a way as to erase or to leave out populations of folks. I think the whites have done that. I don't think white people sit around and say, how can you screw up the black people? I think certainly that's been the history in some respects, but I think it's the way that the structure was created to begin with, and I think that the way that, and the whole thing about whites as racism, white people benefit from race. They benefit in that they don't have to worry about being politicized when they stand up and speak to an audience of white people. That's a privilege that whites have, right? It's a privilege based on race. White people don't have to worry about being followed in a store. When you walk in a store and you have people trailing you, right? Are they trailing me because I look good, or are they trailing me because I'm black and they assume that I'm going to steal something from them? White people don't have to worry about driving and being pulled over because they're black. White people don't have to worry about, white people have a curriculum in school that testifies to the existence that they exist as a people, right? All of this stuff, and there's a number of other things that testify that whites sort of dominate the discussion. So I think that that is inherently racist, in that whites are thinking about themselves in order to self-preserve their culture, their value at the expense of other groups. And so I think that there, if you look at racism, and this is majority, this is where a lot of my students err, is because they tend to personalize this, right? It's that, well, I'm a racist. Racism is things that you do. I'm suggesting that racism is being, just being in the world. I'm suggesting that, and I think until whites deconstruct that model, deconstruct that schema, the question is not guilt, the question is responsibility. What can you do as a responsible, critically minded white person to end racism, right? As much as men and women ought to be working toward ending sexism. Now I want to say one last question about this, because I put myself in the camp of racist. I'm a racist. I see myself very much as a racist, but not in the same way. Right? I see myself as a racist individually in that I, at times, believe the stuff that whites say about me as a black person. How can I not? Right? When I'm socialized to see it all over the place, right? So I fight those discriminatory images of myself as a black person all the time. Right? So racism, if you look at racism as an individual act of aggression, then whites can say, I'm not a racist, I don't do that to people. If you look at racism as a structure, whereby whites have benefited from the structure, right, that's a whole other argument. Getting students to that point is bringing the racist questions like you raised out.
In fact, Darren, you just mentioned it's a state of being, and that is whites are racist not because they're white, but because they're human beings. Because they're human beings, they have social constructs by which you navigate and move through the world. So we are all racist because we are human beings and we have cognitive structures in our brain that help us, you know, organize the way in which we see and understand things. So it very much... if you really want to get to the heart and make changes, you have to dismantle those social constructs before you can move on to the other kinds of issues we've been talking about.
I think we're going to have to put an end to it because our time is up. Dan, one quick comment, if you could.
When I teach, and it may be heresy, and they haven't taken my calling away yet, I say that I think the church can make... I don't think the Lord will let the church be run into the ground, but I think he'll let mistakes happen that he's going to... When the leaders get up there, he's going to say, what the heck were you thinking with that? And one of them is the church being brought up in a racist time period and having some racist policies. And that I don't personally believe that God said that's how it is. And they haven't taken my calling away yet from saying that. And I do find with models that this other panelist was talking about it interesting that how strong the injunction against criticizing leaders is, that with a model that says don't do it, people naturally say our leaders weren't racist or bigots or any such thing. It's God that is. And it's just interesting that model is so ingrained that we'd rather pin it on God.
Wait, this is just a final comment, just to follow up to Dan's comment. Alan and I was having a side dialogue when Michael was talking, and Alan indicated that, you know, he shouldn't be blamed for what his forebears did. And I would absolutely agree with you, 100%. The fact of the matter is, you benefit from what your forebears did. And until you acknowledge that and begin to dismantle it, like Mike said, cognitively, if we can't get white people to move beyond this idea of race as attitudes and beliefs, which is not racism, that's prejudice. Racism is something very different from that. We can't get whites to get out of being stuck in this notion of that I'm not a racist because I don't do this. We're never going to move forward. we're going to continue to remain stagnant. And I would argue that racism as an institutional practice is no longer Jim Crowism like it was prior to 64, 65, but it's now colorblind racism. I don't see color. I don't see you as a person of color. Right. Give me a break. I think we've shifted that discussion into something a little bit more different. So I think that the critical work needs to be done. In closing, I think whites need to take responsibility for that and move with that.
Thank you, Darren and Mike. Let's give them a hand. And now the real discussions begin.